Some Facebook users can now call for violence against Russian soldiers. They're even allowed to call for Vladimir Putin's death. That's after the company tweaked its hate speech policy in response to the war in Ukraine. But what are the consequences? This is Inside Story. Hello, welcome to the program. I'm Adrian Finnegan. Meta, the company that owns Facebook and Instagram, could soon be banned in Russia as an extremist organization. The Kremlin announced that it's blocking Instagram, a move that will affect some 80 million users. Now, this is all in response to Meta announcing a change in its hate speech policy, allowing violent posts in some instances. There's now a partial exception when the targets are Russian soldiers in Ukraine. Meta's decision is part of a wave of corporate action against the Russian invasion of Ukraine. A spokesman for the company says that its platforms will continue to ban violent posts against Russian civilians. Well, here's part of the statement from Meta's Global Affairs President Nick Clegg. He says, "Our policies are focused on protecting people's rights to speech as an expression of self-defense in reaction to a military invasion of their country. To be clear, we're only going to apply this policy in Ukraine itself. We have no quarrel with the Russian people." So much to discuss. Let's bring in our guests for today. From London, we're joined by Mahsa Alimardani, who's an internet researcher at the Oxford Internet Institute. From Preston, Lancashire, Amy Binns is senior lecturer in digital journalism at the University of Central Lancashire. And in London, Tim Squirrell, head of communications and editorial at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. Welcome to you all. Mahsa, let's start with you. Are Meta's changes to its hate speech policy here a perfectly reasonable reaction to Russia's actions in Ukraine, or something chillingly dangerous?
I mean, I would answer that question by looking at what kind of precedent Meta has in applying its policies consistently. I mean, we have other countries where we have had Russian forces invade. We have the same thing occurring in Syria. However, this exception has not been made for Syrians. I mean, there's a host of countries that can make these kinds of calls and face these exceptions. Armenia, Ukraine, Poland, Lithuania, there's a host of these countries. None of them include Syria. So, and this is part and parcel of a lot of policies. We see inconsistencies in the application of these. Another, frightening thing to consider is the fact that why do we want to be calling, making threats against Russian soldiers? There is, I mean, this is something the former United Nations Special Rapporteur said, which is you would want Russian soldiers to have a culture where they can disaffect and withdraw from this war, not to be further demonized. So it's very concerning what kind of implications this can have and what kind of evidence for the benefits this kind of policy can have.
Amy, Meta is effectively decreeing that some people are just so terrible that it's OK for us to say violent and threatening things to, and that it has the power to decide who we can use such language against, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting point, that for very, very many years, Facebook and the other big social media companies have avoided regulation on the grounds that they're just platforms, they're not publishers. They're just platforms where people can go and say whatever they like, and Facebook or Instagram or Twitter are not responsible for what people say. But what we're seeing here is Facebook is making an editorial judgment. They're behaving like a publisher, just the same way as a newspaper says, we'll publish this reader's letter and we won't publish that reader's letter. So I think in the long term, what we can see is more evidence that these are not really just platforms at all. They are very large, powerful media businesses, and they are publishers making editorial judgments.
Tim, I could see you nodding there. Is Meta effectively saying here that it's perfectly reasonable, it's OK to single out people from one country and one country alone and gives them the green light for what amounts to hate speech, What are the implications of that?
I think the difficulty here is that this is being reported as a result of a single leak of a single carve-out. And Facebook Meta has historically been extremely inconsistent enforcing its policies across different regions. They've recently become a little bit better in sort of the Western world and English-speaking world enforcing these policies. But if you look at, for example, my organization's research in the MENA region, you can see that when it comes to non-English-speaking spaces, incitement to violence is one of the things that happens quite a lot, but there are a multitude of sins which occur unchecked in these spaces. So it's not necessarily the case that this is the only exception. And also what we know is that the more complicated the policy and the more carve-outs they create, the more temporary measures they create, the harder it's going to be to consistently enforce that in a way that's actually fair to all of its users.
So, Marcel, picking up on what Tim was saying there, what's to stop people in other countries who are also victims of war calling for them to be allowed to use hate speech against those they perceive as their aggressors?
I mean, that's a really good question. And I mean, I have worked on a particular case that is similar. In Iran, in July 2021, we saw protests break out in various cities, especially in the province of Khuzestan. And we had hundreds of cases from Instagram, the most popularly used platform in Iran, of takedowns of protest footage of people saying death to Khamenei, who is the supreme leader in Iran. And this is very much a ritualized call. It's not a credible threat, of course, against Khamenei's life, but it's more a chant of dissidents amongst the people. And so Facebook was removing these posts. And so after going to them with receipts, with evidence of the hundreds of these cases, they came out and they made an exception. They said for a 2-week period, we will allow Iranian users to post death to Khamenei. I mean, as advocates, we weren't totally on board with this change because death to Khamenei is kind of an evergreen chant amongst Iranians. But it was interesting that this was the reaction. And what I do want to know is what were the, you know, like, were there advocates bringing evidence that this was a needed policy? Were there actually Ukrainians getting their content removed because they were making these calls? It's interesting to know. And of course, like much of the policies, there isn't very much transparency. For the Iran case, I know about this because I worked on it myself. But it would be interesting to know and to question why it is that Facebook or Meta has been so proactive on the Ukraine case, but they had not been proactive in other crises. We were seeing the crises in May 2021 in Palestine when the Gaza Strip was getting bombarded, and there was no proactive reaction. It was weeks of activists, digital rights activists, Palestinian activists coming with evidence of hundreds of takedowns, of hundreds of different ways that users were being stymied and documenting evidence of human rights abuses. And it was after about a 2-week period that they came out and said, we are going to have a crisis center for Israel and Palestine for this situation. But with Ukraine, it was almost immediate. And there should be a lot of questions about how Meta is prioritizing what it considers crises and whose, you know, human rights and whose freedom of expression that they seem to value more.
Amy, I want to explore some more the implications for free speech here control over who can say what and when, this power that the social media giants yield. I mean, what are the implications for free speech? Should social media spaces just be a free-for-all? Should you be able to say what you want, unrestricted, unregulated, or should it be highly policed with penalties for those who abuse the social media spaces and use hate speech on them? I mean, it's got to be one or the other, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has really. And these companies all really started up very naively in California, in the home of free speech, with the idea that people are going to be allowed to say whatever they want. And over time, what they found is that that leads to all kinds of problems. It leads to bullying. It leads to all kinds of terrible things, like young people seeing images of anorexia, all kinds of things. And it, so it's become a more regulated space. Personally, I am in favour of it being a more regulated space. I think the idea that free speech is always a good thing is a peculiarly American idea. And I think that inevitably it leads to problems, as I say, of bullying, of increased hatred. I think in this particular case, it doesn't actually matter that much. We talk about inciting hatred. Well, these people already hate each other. They're already at war with each other. They're already shooting each other. I don't think allowing people to express that is actually going to change very much. But generally speaking, I'm in favour of regulation.
Okay, but who is going to regulate? We're talking about giant American corporations. Congress isn't going to legislate against them. Again, it comes down to them being allowed to self-regulate. And as we're seeing, that just doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, I think you say Congress isn't willing to regulate, but actually what we're seeing, even in America and here in Britain and in Australia, governments are starting to look at regulation, at applying law to these social media companies, because they simply have too much power in a very, very small number of hands. So I think what we've been seeing for a number of years now, perhaps 3 or 4 years, is patience running out. Governments are looking at bringing in regulations against them.
Tim, I can see you nodding. Perhaps you want to come in on that. But let me put something to you here. Donald Trump remains banned from Twitter and Facebook for inciting violence ahead of the Capitol riot in Washington, D.C. in January 2021. And here we have Facebook and Instagram saying that it's fine to incite violence against Vladimir Putin and Russian soldiers. I mean, how do we explain the double standards there?
I think the crucial thing here isn't necessarily just the double standard, but again, the lack of scrutiny and lack of regulation that Facebook and other social media companies are subject to here. So we know that there are enormous problems on these platforms: misinformation, weaponized hatred, disinformation, extremism, calls for incitement to violence. These are running rampant across these spaces, and that's just from the relatively limited picture of the information that we do have. The fact is that Meta and other social media platforms just are not subject to the same degree of transparency regulations that they should be. And so we don't get to know the extent of the problems, and therefore we don't get to know why they're making policies in one space and not in another. So we don't know what this particular policy is in response to. And really what matters is that in the regulations that are forthcoming in the UK, in the EU, in Australia, we need to have requirements for Facebook, for Instagram, for all of the other companies to be transparent with their data and allow researchers access to it so we can see what's actually going on and how they're affecting society. They have a massive power and they have basically no responsibility to go with it.
Marcia, talking of these double standards, what are we to make of social media companies' sudden moves to take down Russian state content and channels? Actors who'd long been allowed to use their platforms to spread propaganda and disinformation without sanction are now suddenly banned. They're just gone.
Right. I mean, again, like has been said, a lot of what's missing is what is the transparency behind the decision? What are the actual costs and benefits? Because we're seeing a lot of discourse, a lot of policy, a lot of private companies, not just Facebook or Meta, trying to put sanctions, either lawful sanctions or just self-initiated ones on different Russian entities. And the question really has to be, what is the benefit in banning these organizations? Are we, losing insight into what these institutions are thinking about? Or are we really putting a stop to rampant misinformation? I mean, we've seen companies stop providing internet services inside of Russia. We've seen, a lot of things that can potentially have a lot of repercussions for ordinary Russians who, in a lot of cases, might not be supporting the war or Putin's regime. And so when you block these institutions from having platforms on Facebook, what are the repercussions? We saw immediately when sanctions were put on these media companies, we saw BBC have sanctions. We saw a lot of Western media that could be valuable be blocked for Russian people. And so I think it's very important to see what the actual costs are for ordinary civilians when you are doing these kinds of, when you're putting these policies in place. And right now, the biggest cost we're seeing is the fact that as of Monday, Russians are not going to be able to access Instagram, and other Western platforms have been similarly banned in reaction to these policies. So is it worth it? Are these policies actually worth the cost that the Russian people are going to have to pay?
Amy, to what extent is the Kremlin, which over the last decade has become a master of disinformation and online subterfuge, to what extent is it now finding itself with the tables turned, that it seriously risks losing the information war over its war in Ukraine?
I think the Kremlin is cracking down extremely hard on their own state media, which is where most ordinary Russians get their information from. So I think in that sense, they're winning by essentially disconnecting from the rest of the world. And I think Facebook has given them an excuse to accelerate that by saying to the Russian people, these people hate you, these people want to incite hatred against you, you can't trust them, we're getting rid of them. So I think, yeah, we're playing into the Kremlin's hands there. I think it's quite cynical what they've done, in that what Facebook has done, in that Facebook knows that if they keep taking down people's content in Ukraine, those people and the people in Belarus and the people in the rest of even Poland will start moving to other platforms. And if they move to other platforms, they probably won't come back. So I think in some ways, this is quite a cynical move, a profit-motivated move.
Tim, do you agree with that?
So it may well be the case that Facebook is a cynical actor here, but I think the more cynical actor is critically the Kremlin. This is probably a policy that they wanted to pursue anyway. They've been trying to essentially militate against Facebook from the early days of this conflict, when Facebook started fact-checking some of their state-run media organizations. And so this has given them absolutely an excuse to do it probably earlier than they would have done. But they were already looking for a reason to shutter Facebook and similar outlets where you can gain access to information which doesn't come from pro-Kremlin sources in Russia. So they are effectively trying to win the information war on the ground with their own people by shuttering independent media, by restricting access to social media platforms where you might be exposed to some other ideas that aren't pro-Kremlin narratives, and allowing to continue operating places like Telegram, where RT and Sputnik and other Russian state-owned media operations have a massive footprint, and where they're able to spread disinformation without much fear of regulation.
Marcia, I want to get your thoughts on that too. With this ban on more mainstream social media than Twitter, Instagram, and the introduction also of stiff penalties for anyone declared to be spreading false news, is the Kremlin basically trying to outlaw information? And will it succeed?
I mean, it's part and parcel of a lot of their efforts for a sovereign internet. I mean, we've been seeing leaks of potential regulations that are going to be nationalizing their internet in reaction to a lot of this, in reaction to potential fears of sanctions stopping actual internet, international internet connections to Russia as well. So, and these, like was mentioned, have been policies that Russia has had longstanding, has been discussing for a while. I mean, the role of Telegram here is very interesting. It's a very controversial platform, both in terms of, you know, what exactly the security guarantees are for its users, but in terms of, you know, its content moderation policies. And by that, I mean, its lack of content moderation policies that allows for a lot of actors that have been deplatformed by the mainstream platforms to come and find their voice and their audience there. So I think as we go forward, it's going to be interesting to see how Telegram's role in this conflict is going to shape up. I mean, we've already seen the founder come out and say that he guarantees security and a place for its Ukrainian users, despite the fact that there has been rumors that, you know, Telegram might have interest to cooperate with Kremlin. So, and as of Monday, it will be the only social media platform that won't be banned in Russia, seeing that most Facebook platforms, Meta and Twitter, will be banned.
Okay. Amy, I just want to ask you as a digital journalism lecturer about how you think that this war has been covered online. It is being played out in real time online. You can follow it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Things like the open source intelligence gatherers who are debunking many Russian claims, for instance. You can watch all of that going on in real time. What do you make of that?
It's fascinating to watch. I mean, obviously, it's distressing to see what we're looking at here. But the way the information is flowing is absolutely fascinating. And the way we're seeing also the clock being rolled back, so we can actually see the previous digital footprint of some of these people. So I'm thinking here about the pregnant lady who was photographed in the maternity hospital. And immediately Russia is saying she's a crisis actor. She's an Instagram star who runs a beauty business. Now, the interesting thing was that was actually true. She had previously been on Instagram as an influencer. But she wasn't a crisis actor. She was a Ukrainian woman who blogged about being pregnant and who now was in that maternity hospital when that bomb hit. So immediately then people were debunking and saying, well, yes, she is this beauty blogger. So I think what we're seeing is this is happening in a place that is already very switched on to media. So we're seeing things responding very quickly.
And Amy, I'm sorry to cut you off. I want to get one last word from Tim here. On that note, Tim, about the switched on population, I just want to get your thoughts on how Ukraine's president is doing with his use of social media. To what extent is he leaving President Putin looking old and out of touch with the fact that Volodymyr Zelensky is everywhere on social media right now?
I think we have to bear in mind that Volodymyr Zelensky may be everywhere on social media in the West, but this isn't a fight that is just being won or fought in the West. It's also one that crucially has been fought domestically in Russia, because this invasion can only continue so long as Putin remains popular and so long as, you know, the body bags start coming back in such a high level that Russia has to think again about what it's doing. So it may be that Zelensky is very popular here and his social media game is pretty strong. But in addition to that, we're seeing that Putin is continuing to create a stranglehold on information in Russia. But I also think that the Russian propaganda game, or the Kremlin propaganda game here, is again also quite strong. So you can see, for example, in response to this latest thing from Meta, that Russia is, or the Kremlin is pushing the hashtag Russian Lives Matter, which is a cynical repurposing of a social justice slogan from sort of Western social justice movements to try to make the claim that Russians and Russian speakers are being victimized both in Ukraine and elsewhere. And that was part of the narrative or the justification that Putin gave for the war in the first place. So it may be the case that Ukraine is putting up a pretty strong fight in the propaganda war, but I wouldn't count the Kremlin out yet.
OK. There, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it. Fascinating discussion. Really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. Mahsa Alimardani, Amy Binns, and Tim Squirrel. Thanks very much indeed. As always, thank you for watching. Don't forget you can see the programme again at any time just by going to our website. You'll find that at aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, join us on our Facebook page. We're at facebook.com/AJInsideStory. And you can join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle at AJInsideStory. From me, Adrian Finnegan, and the whole team here in Doha, thanks for watching. I'll see you again. Bye-bye.